Hello to everybody today, and welcome to our Harry Media broadcast, Harry Media TV. Last week we spoke about a topic which was very relevant to everybody. It was certainly relevant to me, and I suppose I represent everybody too in many ways. I spent the week trying to dive into my unconscious, trying to uncover all that should be uncovered. I'm not sure if I succeeded. I'm not sure if I got to where I was supposed to go, but I got somewhere. But one very interesting thing that I did realize was that everything has to have a location. Now, I know that sounds a little strange, so I'll explain that. That when we speak about things, we always try to locate them in some space. So naturally, when we talk about physical things exist in a space. They have a place where they sit or where they act. We can define them in terms of the space that they're in. And there are certain things which we have a hard time doing that with. There are certain things which don't necessarily fit in space in the same way as a thing. For example, we can see that everything related to the senses can be somehow or another specified in terms of a place. But things which are not directly connected to the senses, we have a much harder time pinpointing a location. Aromas always have a source, and they fill air in a certain space. And if you were to move to another space, the aroma would dissipate. The same is true with sound. The same is true with things that you see. And when you feel physically, for example, somebody touches you here, you know, I am touched at that spot. There was this influence which has caused some kind of impression upon me. But then there's other things which, as I said before, are not directly connected to the senses, which defy location to some extent. For example, when I think, the thought processes which are in my mind are very difficult to pinpoint in any location other than my head. Now, okay, we understand the mind is related to the brain because the thought process physiologically interfaces with the brain. And after all, when we have reactions through what we think and everything, it's because the mind and the brain are intimately related. Now, it's very interesting when we talk about the brain, when we talk about the mind, because we tend to think that it's situated in the head, and therefore we are feeling very comfortable about the thought process because we think we know where it is in space. But what's even more interesting is that many times this is a type of a cheating process which causes us to become very mental. Now often people, they think a lot. We have this tendency as people to think a lot, to get on what we call the mental platform and just see everything as a mental thing. For example, when we even talk about a philosophy, even a religious philosophy, a spiritual philosophy, which is after all something that we all wish to have, especially in this broadcast, it becomes very much a thought process. You read books, you hear from others, you discuss, you observe. It's very much a process which is easily accommodated within the mind and the brain. And this process also can become very comfortable as a detached mental process. In other words, we don't have to embrace any of these thoughts with our emotions because they can be very pleasantly located in the brain and the mind. The mind has its home in the brain. The mind feels comfortable in the brain, and we therefore feel comfortable with the mind feeling comfortable with the brain. Now we think that this process of thought is under our control. For after all, we can make little experiments and think about this and think about that, and we think, well, we're in control. And because of these little experiments we do and these little reinforcements we have that we are in control, we feel very comfortable with the mind. We don't have any problem with it. Until the mind starts to think about things we don't really feel good about, then we try to stop that, but it doesn't happen, then we don't feel so good about the mind anymore. Then we start to understand the mind isn't really under our control. The mind has a separate kind of avenue down which it drives according to its own design. And it's only periodically when we fool ourselves by thinking we're controlling a particular thought process for some time that we actually are convinced that it's really under our control. Now, some people, they are very powerful in the mind. They actually have, perhaps through yogic discipline or other forms of discipline, really managed to control what happens in that space. And some of them are even so expert at what they do, they're called mentalists, which means they have such great power of capacity over the mind, they're able to create illusions. By the power of the mind, they are able to create illusions in other people's minds that other people may think in particular ways. So the power of the mind is so great that when you tap into the source of that power, there in the mental platform, you can even do things with it. Now we all have experience with that. We have experience of the power of positive thinking and the destructive power of negative thought. And we know thought is power because what you meditate on, how you consider, how you conceive, these things you create. However, all that which goes on in that platform of thought is actually very distinct from other aspects of our life which have at least equal importance, if not even more importance. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because, as we started to speak about, we want to find out where are things located. And what I'm really interested is, where is the unconscious located? What space does the unconscious work within? You know, I think it's important now that I give you a kind of a synopsis, a kind of a summary of what I'm going to talk about here, because it's a complicated issue, yet it's based on this one point. And it was basically what I needed to answer to find the unconscious, because if I knew where it was, I would know where to go to find it. So I was looking, and I had a hard time finding it until I came to understand. To find it, you have to do a little bit of alchemy. Now, generally people think of alchemy in terms of the ancients trying to create gold by a mixture of metals. In other words, you take very valueless substances, mix them together, and create a very valuable substance. And it was always related to the mixture of lead and mercury, because they knew that there was this elemental connection between these two ingredients, and if they could somehow be forced to combine or induced to combine, one could get this gold. Now, I don't personally believe the whole, shall we say, motivation, the whole ideal of these people was to create gold in and of itself. I think the ideal was the alchemical process, the success in the alchemical process. In other words, by creating that success in the alchemical process, they would be explaining, or they would be giving a formula for the way in which existence functions. And that's actually true, because if you can make things happen that shouldn't happen under normal circumstances, you are tapping into the secrets of how things are done. And I think that's fantastic, because if you are able to do that, you've practically got the keys of existence in your hand. But, you know, now when I'm talking about it's practically an alchemical process to come in contact with the unconscious, I don't mean anything related to physical matter like creating gold. Yet from the spiritual point of view, it is an alchemical process, because it's taking two different, distinct ingredients and combining them in such a way to open the gateways of existence. So these two ingredients that I'm speaking of, the first one we've already talked about, the mind, the thought process, that way in which these thoughts integrate with the brain. And we can immediately understand one of the problems in this alchemical process, because the mind is not even under our own control. So we're going to have to use as one of these ingredients in this alchemical process something which we aren't even have under our own control, which is within our own framework of existence. And the next process is just as tricky, just as slippery, the next element of this alchemical process. You've got, for instance, this heart, these emotions. You've got the emotional body, this body which is this incredible ocean of feeling, this incredible ocean of emotion. Now, if you think about it, you've got this body which is in this very interesting way absorbed in thought, absorbed in emotion, absorbed in various things which make it extremely difficult to have a conscious control over what's happening. You've got these feelings which can somehow rage on all by themselves out of control. And you've got this mind which can wander off in any direction it wants. And when we talk about emotions, we have a vague feeling that they're connected to the heart and to the Manipura chakra, the Anahata Manipura chakra area, just in this, in the chest, in the top of the body. We don't think in terms of the emotions being involved, for example, in our feet. We don't talk about emotional feet. We don't talk about emotional knees. We don't talk about emotional rear end. We don't talk about emotional shoulders. We talk about emotions in the heart. We talk about feeling it in our gut. So we have a very specific place where these emotions are centered. We have a very specific area, a space where we feel comfortable with thinking about the center of emotion. So the mind, we feel comfortable in this head space, in the emotions, we feel comfortable in this chest space. Now, you would assume that if you would want to contact the thought process, you would go up here into this head space and look around. And you would assume if you want to find out about this emotional thing here, you would go into the chest space, the heart space, you would poke around and find out. But we all know it's not like that. We all know that in reality, it's quite different. The reality is very interesting, because if you want to find out about thought, you have to use thought to find it out. And by chasing thoughts with thoughts, you get quite tired and very lost very rapidly. And if you reach into the chest area and you try to chase emotions, well, everybody knows when you try to chase emotions with the mind, that you just have like a very humorous situation. If you try to describe your emotions in words from the platform of the mind, in other words, you are detached from your emotions and you're simply in an analytical way describing them, people will think you're very mental, you're very dry, you're very cold. And if you then try to describe your emotions emotionally, in other words, if you are describing with words your hatred or your love, then the words become basically very emotional, mushy. They lose their analytical quality. And your descriptions basically just carry the emotions in the words. And all people are perceiving is the emotion in the word, not the word itself. So we all know the perfection of expression is the marriage of the mind and the heart to perfectly express in a very clear way exactly how you are feeling. This is the mind and the heart connection. And this is alchemy. Because you're taking these two very different, in fact, as different as you can get, things that happen to share your consciousness, happen to share your energy, and you have to put them together in a way in which they create something new. Now, the rarest amongst persons have that as a natural means by which they live, a natural mode of their expression, the complete connection between the mind and the heart. But for the rest of us, we don't have that. We are always living somewhere in this place or that place, maybe even unaware of how we're living. And we have to do work. We have to make efforts to make that alchemical connection, that alchemical combination between the mind and the heart. Now, it's my conclusion. You know, all of this is very theoretical, but it was my conclusion last week that the unconscious is in the space created by the alchemical connection, the potential of the alchemical connection. And what I realized was that when there's not the connection between the mind and the heart, the alchemy is not there, so the unconscious exists in that void. Now, I don't mean void in the, shall we say, Buddhistic sense of the term. I mean the void, which means the space that exists because the mind is not there and the heart is not there. Let's put it another way to make this clearer. We are supposed to be connected between the mind and the heart. That's our natural state. This is our essence. This is our being. This is what we are. And because of that, this place of unity, this place of cohesiveness, this holistic energy by nature exists. Because it exists and it's always existing, this space is always there. Now, when the mind and the heart are not connected in the alchemical connection, the space is not filled with the proper energy. So the space becomes known as the unconscious. And conversely, we now know, I mean, if this is all correct, I think it is, but anyway, we now know the way in which you can contact the unconscious by simply making the alchemical combination, which then immediately has access to that space. Let me move back a little bit. My week began with trying to think of things, trying to remember things, and on that platform of the mind, tap into my unconscious. That didn't work. I mean, I really tried. I remembered this, and I remembered that, and I analyzed this, and I analyzed that. Got nowhere. Actually, I got very tired. Then I got into the, I'm going to feel this, and I'm going to feel, and I'm going to feel. That was even worse. I mean, I didn't get anywhere with that because you can't remember feelings. You can only feel feelings. So here I was trying to remember my feelings or contact my feelings or think about things. And I realized that I couldn't succeed in either of these ways. So then something interesting happened. At one moment, I remembered something and felt something. I felt the feeling associated with the memory because it was somehow still active, and immediately something came up. And then I immediately understood. Alchemy. It just combined. It just worked. Boom! There it is. The unconscious is tapped when the heart and the mind meet. When the heart and the mind combine in a perfect alchemical reaction, you will get access into the unconscious. Well, I could go on and explain what happened next, but it wouldn't help you because I have this wonderful thing called a chakra belt. It's a cocoon, a chakra cocoon that I put myself in with various tachyonized discs and everything. And I lay in front of my deities, with my head to the deities, and just in this cocoon. And then I go into this world of thought feeling. And so I just, in that belt, let the thoughts flow, let the feelings flow with the thoughts, and let the energy just mix in that way and create that alchemy. And boom, there was the unconscious, totally in awareness. And then the question came, well, where is it? Okay, we contacted it. We know it's an alchemical process. You mix, you get, you go, but where do you go? Again, you know, the emotions are here, the mind is there. Well, where is the unconscious? Well, in that chakra belt, I realized it's just my aura, my energy that is expanded around me. My unconscious is just my energy. I was unaware of my energy. And therefore, I was unconscious of my energy. So my unconscious is my energy. Now, I know that sounds a little bit obvious and yet at the same time a little bit corny, but actually there's something to be understood here. Corny, it means like, you know, a little bit crude humor. Because if you think about it, in my energy, my mind is in my energy, my emotions are in my energy, all my feeling and perceptions are in my energy. So I'm not unconscious of my energy. It's not like my aura is something filled with just unconsciousness. So then we get to dimensionality. The multiplicity of dimensions within our energy. Now, you may have heard people talking about energetic bodies. And they always draw pictures with the form of the body and then one layer and then another layer and then another layer. And so they show this body with all these different layers going outwards from it. And they always show that as you go further away, it becomes more and more subtle, more refined, more evolved. And I'm sorry to admit, I've been reading that for years. And every time I see this chart, I go, oh God, not another one of these stupid charts that say absolutely nothing because these people don't know what they're talking about. Boom. The same old chart again that they just drag out because somebody made a chart somewhere long ago. Now, I know better than that. I know that these are not stupid people. I know these are very advanced, wonderful people who have great experience and so on. I'm just annoyed at this simplistic expression that everybody seems to use because they just don't know a better way to do it. Now, I have to say I just dug my own grave where you put dead bodies. You know a grave when you die and they bury you in the ground? So when you say you dug your own grave, that means you just said something or did something so stupid that you've dug a hole and you're going to have to stick yourself in it. So I've dug my own grave by saying that because anything I say after this is going to be me blowing my trumpet saying, hey, I got it. And I'm going to sound like a complete idiot, and so I should therefore shut up and play some music. But I already dug my grave, so I may as well just get into it and start putting the earth on top. You missed it. I said I've already dug the grave, so I may as well get into it and start putting the earth on top. Look, we don't need a chart with these little lines moving out from the body. That particular alchemy, that particular way in which it all works, these spaces, are multidimensional. There are different dimensions that share the same space. And when you, with your conscious intention, vibrate on the frequency of the mind, you enter to the mental space. When you vibrate the frequency of the heart, you enter into the emotional space. When you vibrate on the frequency of your knee, you enter into your knee space. That's even a very interesting point, because who's aware of his knee generally? Generally, you don't think about it. But if you put your mind on it and you start feeling your knee, all of a sudden you're aware of it and it's like a new experience. Otherwise, you never think about it unless it hurts you. Now, in the same way, you move into other people's space. You can move your frequency. You can attune yourself to other people and be aware of their space. So you have this great access to what's in your energy, what's in your aura. You can even go into the meditative state and access all that spiritual energy that is there surrounding you. But there are other dimensions within this that you can only access through alchemy. In other words, those dimensions which are closed to us right now become opened within our energy field by the alchemical combination between the heart and the mind. And then all of a sudden, that which is within our aura, which was completely hidden from us, and which only affected us incidentally, now becomes clear. In other words, it's there because it's in our energy, it affects us, but when we're unaware of it, it's like having some pest shooting us with some little needles from behind all the time, and we're going, who is that? Who is that? And when we are connected in that alchemical, we understand all of a sudden all of that. And then it just makes perfect sense. Now there's another dimension. And this dimension is, I guess, the best of all. Now you remember I said you could also be in a meditative state and connect to the spirituality of it. Now some people say, yeah, I meditate. Yeah, I've done that meditation. But you know, it doesn't really do that much for me. Or another would say, yeah, I do this meditation and it makes me feel good. I feel good about it. It's good for my health. It relaxes me. Another would say, yeah, I meditate and it helps to clear my thoughts and I come to conclusions and I figure out problems better. All of this is correct because meditation is not an end in itself. It's just a tool. It's a process. Now when you consider meditation in connection with alchemy, you can come to yet another dimension, which is the sweetest one of all. We talked about the alchemy between the mind and the heart. Yet, when you connect that alchemy of mind and heart with the spiritual energy, the core, the essence, you get a deeper form of alchemical reaction. This is the basis of bhakti. Bhakti is a very interesting process, which is not very well understood. It is the alchemical reaction between a very clear and powerful mind, a very pure and open heart, in complete harmony and union with our spiritual essence and being. Just think about that. You've got people who practice bhakti nowadays, they got all this philosophy. They have a lot to talk about. And that's okay. Previously, people who were scholars and everything used to criticize Lord Chaitanya because they thought he was surrounding himself with emotionalists. Because they were filled with this emotion while they were chanting. The problem with the modern followers of Lord Chaitanya, to a large extent, is they've got this philosophy thing down really well. They can talk a lot. But they don't got that same feel. They don't have the same feeling as was there within Lord Chaitanya's group. I mean, they do feel sometimes, and they certainly think a lot. And there's some spirituality there, too. And very rarely do these combine in that alchemical reaction. But unless the alchemy is there between these three things, you don't have bhakti. You have something that appears to be bhakti. You have something which looks very official, very proper. And because those who do that kind of a thing are very, they need to reinforce it. So there are many rules, there are many regulations, there are many disciplines, there are many ways in which one is limited because it seems to reinforce the experience. Now, there's not, in essence, there's not something wrong with that. I'm not saying there's something wrong, but I'm saying that the effect of that is the gradual repression and the gradual replacement of the emotion with thought. With the real feeling or the real bhakti with an image of it. The reality of bhakti is that it's an alchemical combination. It's a mystical combination. Bhakti is the most mystical of all of the processes. You've got the alchemical combination of an extremely clear, an extremely powerful mental process by which it's understood. And you've got this very open and very loving and very powerful emotional basis. Now, if I have to now speak about the spirit as separate from that, that is a very significant point. Let's run back again, because I separated mind and heart. Mind and heart made an alchemy. Mind and heart alchemy allowed us to enter into the unconscious. So far, these two things seem to be very much of the here and the now. I don't want to use the word material because that's a silly designation of it. We're talking about the here and the now of it. The reason we have to now take a third step in our alchemical combination is because the spirit, the essence, the being, is something unique as a source of the catalyst by which the alchemical reaction will blossom. So you have the alchemical combination of the mind and the heart. Now, within that already existing alchemical combination, it's kind of like you take gold and put something else on it and you get platinum. You put the being. In other words, you go into the meditative state and you bring the alchemical, the already combined, alchemically combined mind and heart. And within the state of being, you embrace that mind-heart alchemy. Therefore, bhakti is first and foremost the state of being, not a state of doing. It is embraced, bhakti, in its reality, in its essence, as a state of being where the alchemical processes have taken place which melded the mind and the heart. So first there is this being that I am, which is embracing the alchemical mind, alchemically joined mind and heart. So, and that space which normally would be in our unevolved state, filled with the unconscious, now is my manifestation of being. Now this is the state of bhakti. But wait, bhakti refers to somehow the Supreme, somehow the Divine, somehow Radha and Krishna, somehow Radha and Krishna and me, and Radha and Krishna and me and everybody else. So, bhakti expands in dimensionality. When I'm in that alchemical perfection, where my being is embracing the alchemically perfect mind-heart combination, I am now ready to engage in a doing or a feel-do. Now, as you move into this, the first way one experiences this in relationship to the divine is that one is simply absorbed in the connection, the feeling, the exchange of love, which is full of knowledge, full of love. So this initial state is where there is that just embrace of bhakti between the lover and beloved. You will experience when that spiritual alchemy has been perfect, Just like when you create gold from lead and mercury, when the spiritual alchemy is perfect, there is this union with the divine. Now, depending on you, depending on the circumstance, depending on your history or whatever, that may or may not last, that may last longer, that may last shorter. For some people, it can last a long time. For some people, less of a time. It depends. Yet, if you analyze, and we who are bhaktas are not averse to analysis because it helps keep clarity always in its pure state, in connection with the pure emotion which alchemically in our being manifests bhakti. So when we analyze, we just think about it. Our being is now alchemically whole, and then there is the divine being. And as we know, the divine being has a very, is a greater power. It's greater power than we are and has greater capacities to manifest in any particular way. But me, being, I manifest in a particular way. It's specifically according to the characteristic of my being. And my characteristic energy is what I am. It's not something I can change, or I would even think of changing, or I would even have a procedure to change. It just is. I feel this is one of the most misunderstood aspects of mystical bhakti. When you're on the platform of the mind, and you are in the apparent realm of bhakti, the concept of changing how you are or how you relate or what you do is easy because it's a mental adjustment. And therefore, it's very easy for somebody to exploit that and tell you, you can become anything you want. You can become, let's say, a gopi. Doesn't matter even if you're not. It's just a question of a process. Now, that may or may not be true, but it's a very, shall we say, disturbing deviation from the alchemical process required to do it. Let's say, for example, no, it is so. The alchemical process depends on my being, and it depends on that being being the catalyst for the further alchemical combination of the already combined mind-heart. In other words, the bhakti, the real bhakti, cannot catalyze into its perfect existence unless the being is the catalyst. So the being is what it is. If you take that which is of the mind, right, and you, with the mind, manipulate or try to define or redefine the being with the mind, you are not affecting the being. You're only affecting the mind. And if you do like that, the whole alchemy breaks instantly. Oh, actually, it never takes place. Because the clear mind, the unalloyed heart, are the first alchemical reactions. The catalyst of our being is the final alchemical reaction. Your being is. It's not something you can change. You can simply remove coverings that you've placed there to keep yourself from connecting to what you are, but you can't change it essentially. You are what you are. If you don't like what you are, think about this. If you don't like what you are, you'd better go back to your unconscious and find out what's there. Think about that. And if you think you can become something spiritual just by thinking yourself that way, you've got an illusion. Okay, let's just, for the sake of argument, accept Goloka Vrindavan with cowherd boys and cowherd girls and all that. Let's just, for the sake of argument, accept that. And you have heard with the mind that being a gopi is the best, and therefore you don't want to have anything else to do with being a cowherd boy. That's not acceptable. Because you want to be the best. I mean, How many people have been influenced by that very thought? Now, why do you want to be the best? I suggest you go into the unconscious. Ah, but you can't get there. Because if you get there, then you'll have to find out things which you are now philosophically averse to. Because you have now philosophically twisted your head to becoming the best, and you have defended yourself very well by accepting the very best person to bring you there. And that person saying you're going to get there and be that gopi because you are. So you're stuck. And you would never consider making the mind-heart connection because those elements are maya. Because the mind is maya, the heart is maya. And maya plus maya equals maya. You have instead gone directly from the mind, directly to spiritual illusion. And then locked the door, thrown away the key, and convinced yourself that if you even think anything else, it's a blasphemy and you're going to destroy your life. So basically you have chained yourself to a belief system. Now, if you actually, forget that for a second, actually have a clear mind, an unalloyed heart, make that connection. And just accept your being as it is, because that's all you are. How can you go wrong? Your being is what it is. You accept that, because if you can't accept what you are, you can never be able to feel your being. You can never be, because you'll always have to do something to deal with your not being what you want to be. Why can't I be? Well, I'm sorry, because I don't want to be it. I don't want to be that. I want to be that. And when I look at what I am, I don't like that. Now, that thought, that idea is total illusion. Because when you are, there's no question of liking it or not liking it. It is. If you had a problem with what you are, it's because somebody else has given you an idea that what you are is not good enough. And because of your unconscious, again, the unconscious, which in there says, you're not good enough. You hear that and you say, yes, I'm not good enough. And therefore, the alchemy cannot take place. It'll never take place. You are locked out of the alchemist's guild. You know, the alchemists, they used to have a secret society. Because they had to make sure this kind of an illusion never entered into it. Well, there was a reason for it. Because as soon as you get blocked out of the process, you can never do it. And that's why bhakti is so rare. Because there are millions and billions of reasons for it not to exist. Now, okay, if you see bhakti just as a process of doing, then somebody will say, well, bhakti's there everywhere. There's people doing this service, people doing that service. And all these services are devotional service, and that is bhakti, and it's right, and it's good. So what are you doing? I can't argue with that, because if you define bhakti as a process of doing, well, then you should just do it. I don't think doing's the answer, because I think bhakti is a process of being. And when you're in that being and the alchemy is there and the spiritual being of what I am is alchemically embraced by the already melded body of the mind and heart, I am now in the perfect situation to start bhakti. And when I'm in that bhakti, that state of being, and I have that connection with the divine, and I'm feeling that flow of existence within that all-pervasive energy of the divine, I know I'm there. Yeah, but when I talk about my being, being is not just it's not like it's formless or amorphous. I have what I am. What I am is unique. Because it has unique qualities which make it different from anyone else. That's why everybody's alchemical process is different. No two people share the same exact alchemical process. Everybody's got their mind, everybody's got their heart, everybody's got their being. Even if the being was the same, let's just say, their mind is different, their heart is different. And to get the combination together, you have to have, if it's going to be the same everywhere, all three have to be the same. It's not so. For those who want to deny what I'm saying, they will reject entirely bhakti as that, or they will reject entirely this entire discussion, and they will say, being is everything and my being is one. But talking about them or discussing them or trying to identify what we are saying in opposition to them is a useless affair. Now, I am what I am, yet that amness has a certain personality. How shall it manifest? Well, here is a very far out thing. I'm going to just throw this out to you. I'm in my being, I'm in that connection, I'm in that love. And of course, the divine is there too. I'm not alone in this. Now, the divine being is interested in me, wishes to make a contact. So let's talk about it from the point of view of Krishna, because everybody will understand this rapidly. So Krishna, let's say, you could call the divine whatever you want, bumps into me. Now, just think about this. You got to think about this in relationship to your experience. Bumps into me to say, hey, what does that hey mean? Well, it depends on me, doesn't it? If I'm a friend, cowherd boy, hey means, hey, friend. If I'm a parent, hey means, hey, mom, take care of me. I'm here. Recognize me. That's how I would react to it. If my friend bumps me as a friend, I wouldn't react by saying, okay, I'll feed you milk now. My reaction would be according to what I am. If Krishna bumps into me and says, hey, and I feel, ooh, wow, and I'm just filled with desire, well then, isn't it obvious what I am? Now, Krishna is not stupid. Krishna is all intelligent. So Krishna already knows what I am. And it takes two to tango. So do you think when Krishna bumps into us, it's a very generic bump? Krishna, with no emotion, with no attachment whatsoever, bumps into me and says, hey, and wonders how I'm going to react. Absolutely not. When Krishna is going to bump into a gopi, it's filled with desire. It just immediately connects on the platform of desire. And immediately the reciprocation just flames like a volcano. Now, can you imagine that Krishna comes in no, let's start this all over again. You're on the mental platform of what you are. You have mentally assumed a role of what you are. And you've decided you're a gopi. Now, because there's no alchemy there, there's really no bhakti there, and there's really no connection there. But because Krishna or God, or we can say Radha Krishna, Krishna or whatever, is very present everywhere, he might still bump into you periodically and say, hey. So think of the schizophrenia of the following situation. Here you are in your mental world as a gopi. Krishna, out of extraordinary mercy, comes into you, bumps into you as a friend, bumps into a friend, and then you feel it, yet it makes no sense. And you feel, wait a minute, Krishna? Embrace as lover. And it doesn't work because actually that's completely inappropriate. But you'd never know it because you don't have the capacity to know it yet. This is the danger of prematurely accepting something without knowing what really is. It's not a question of qualification. It's not a question of accumulating discipline. It's a question of the alchemy. And until that alchemy crystallizes, the bhakti won't manifest like that. Sure, you can do things. Sure, you can dress the part. Sure, you can speak the part. Sure, you can do all that stuff. But you're not that until you are that. And you'll not be, when you are that, you don't need to show it. You don't need to dress it. You don't need to speak it. Because these things don't define what you are. That doesn't mean you can't express what you are, but the expression doesn't define you. The expression defines what you wish to express. So therefore, this whole alchemical process is the key. It's the key. The very desire to come in contact with that unconscious we spoke about last week brings together these elements of the process. And when these elements of the process are brought together, and you have come in contact with that which makes you what you are, the whole universe of spiritual experience opens to you. And I don't want to define what that is. I don't wish to define how your experience is going to move, what you should think, how you should think, what it should be. I felt my role today was simply to explain the process by which bhakti is assembled as an entity, and how bhakti is a state of being from which all doing may manifest. Okay, somebody may say, but what are you doing? Somebody may look at me and say, I mean, what are you doing really here? You don't do anything. You do all this ordinary junk all week long, you know, and you come out here and you blah, blah on Saturday. I mean, you know, what are you doing? Okay, I'm not doing all that much, you know, but I'm understanding the being and coming to understand the alchemy of it. In other words, life is a research laboratory. I could tell you my occupation is research scientist. I work in a laboratory. And I'm reestablishing the system of alchemy, which is the mystical process of bhakti. And the funny thing is that I'm pretty happy with that because I know it works for me. And I really hope that what I have explained today gives some indication of how you can undergo your own alchemical process to enter into that state of being called bhakti. And I am totally convinced that once you're in that state of being, everything from that point on will be obvious. You don't need any direction. And besides all of this, it's quite possible that just by trying to understand your unconscious in your own particular way, you may come to your own alchemical process. And if you do, write me. I want to know about it.